writing the first draft of The History of Hitler's Germany.
One of the real things I discovered in doing the research for Hitlerland is that when you put yourself in the shoes of the Americans at the time, things that seem perfectly obvious in retrospect simply did not seem so obvious, and you sort of ask yourself, what would I have understood? How perceptive would I have been?
That's journalist Andrew Nagorski. We talked to him about his fascinating book, Hitlerland, American Witnesses to the Nazi Rise to Power. And later in the show, novelist Jonathan Rabb tells us about his latest, The Second Son. It's about a Berlin detective in the midst of the Spanish Civil War. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. History is usually written when the outcome of events is known and enough time has elapsed to judge what's happened. But the first draft of history is written by the eyewitnesses when the course of events is not so easy to discern. Take Nazi Germany. When Hitler began his rise to power, there were many who initially supported him, others who withheld judgment, and still others who quickly saw the brutal nature of his regime. Among those were some 150 American diplomats and journalists. They fell into all three categories, from the American who was Hitler's publicist to foreign correspondent William Shirer, who early on took Hitler's accurate measure. Now, journalist Andrew Nagorski has come out with the never-before-told story of those Americans in Hitlerland, American Witnesses to the Nazi Rise to Power. Andrew Nagorski worked as a foreign correspondent and editor for Newsweek for 3 decades and is now with the East-West Institute. He says that William Shirer's book, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, was one of the inspirations for Hitlerland.
Certainly, that was the Bible of that period for so many years, and I read it in college and then referred back to it countless times when I was a correspondent in Germany. It still is, despite all the wonderful histories of that period and biographies of Hitler, I think the seminal work that stands up quite well today. And I was also inspired by his Berlin diary, where he had fabulous descriptions of his actual time in Berlin.
Like the real eyewitness to history. Talk a little bit about Shirer, because he was, probably the most impressive of all the people you talk about in this book, because he really didn't allow the wool over his eyes pretty much at all.
Yes, I think there are a couple of people in this book who really stand out. William Shirer is one of them. He's probably the best known, and I'll get back to him in a moment. I'd also like to point out that, of course, I start in the 20s. My book tries to give the American perspective on events there in the 20s and the 30s. So you see all of the whole situation as Hitler begins to emerge on the national scene. And there was also someone called Edgar Maurer, who is a correspondent for the Chicago Daily News, who was a very famous correspondent in his time, but is now largely forgotten, who was a tremendously smart and brave and perceptive individual. He really saw this coming. He was in Germany until 1933 when Hitler took power, and by September of 1933, he was basically driven out of the country. Shirer comes in 1934, once Hitler's already in power, but in where many people are still trying to figure out this new leader out and are not sure what to take seriously and what not to take seriously. And Shirer is one of these people who just instantly senses just how dangerous the situation is, and all the way through in his reporting you see this clear-eyed vision of it that's rare in the midst of these kinds of epic events. One of the real things I discovered in doing the research for Hitlerland is that when you put yourself in the shoes of the Americans at the time, things that seem perfectly obvious in retrospect simply did not seem so obvious, and you sort of ask yourself, What would I have understood? How perceptive would I have been? Much less how courageous possibly I might have been or not. And I think it raises a lot of questions.
And of course, 2020 hindsight is always very easy. Not so easy when you're right there. You in fact, divide the Americans in Berlin into three different categories. Those who were pretty much completely taken in by the Nazis, or maybe not, if not completely, who were quite willing to support them. Those who were who withheld judgment for some time, and those like Scheurer who quickly realized the truly brutal nature of the regime. You know, aside from, you know, individual personality and differences, is there anything that you could identify that would have put somebody into one category or another, kind of, you know, where they were coming from, why they took the position they did?
Well, I think part of it was, yes, where, as you say, where they're coming from intellectually, morally, psychologically. I think if you step back and think about, again, trying not to look at events in hindsight, when something's happening right in front of your eyes and you say you have a radical leader making all sorts of threats against the Jews, political opponents, everyone else, we all have a tendency, I think, in the first instance to think some of this is just overblown, it's drama, it's to rally the base, to put it in today's terms. It sometimes takes an act of the imagination to go beyond your conventional thinking to say, in this case, this radical leader means this literally, and this is a threat that we cannot wish away, and that there's going to be a confrontation. And a lot of people don't want to think in those terms. For instance, Americans did not want to think in between the wars that they would be get involved. Most Americans didn't want to consider the possibility that they'd be involved in another world war in Europe. World War One had been bad enough. So that's part of it. Part of it is again, that personal contact. Remember, these people are seeing, for instance, in my book, I go back and trace the first Americans to meet Hitler before he's a household name, way back as far as 1922. And what do they see? What do they understand? What do they predict? It's interesting that some of the ones who were there, who did that in the beginning, Carl von Wegen, a Hearst correspondent, and Truman Smith, a young military attaché from the Berlin embassy, immediately saw that this was what they called a marvelous demagogue, and marvelous in the sense that a very skillful demagogue who could really rally his supporters, while others quickly dismissed him because he seemed so odd, unconventional, and to be almost a caricature of himself. So, yeah, reporters and diplomats and others have to make some snap judgments, and sometimes it's very calculated, sometimes it's pure instinct, gut instinct, you know, what to take seriously and what not to take seriously.
You have some marvelous characters in the book. Among them is Putzi Hanfstengel, kind of a German-American. Tell us about him.
Yes, I mean, in that category, which you mentioned before, of Americans who were simply wowed by Hitler, Putzi's right up there. Now, Putzi was German, was half German, half American. His father was from Bavaria, from a very, very well-known art dealer's family, and his mother was from Boston, from the Sedgwick family, a very well-known family in Boston. His grandfather had been a Civil War general. He even carried Lincoln's coffin, and he went to Harvard, class of 1909, very big, expressive guy, played the piano, entertaining. He met people like Teddy Roosevelt Jr. in his class, even was invited to the White House. After college, he spends the time in New York running the family art shop, marries a woman named Helen, who's a born New Yorker, although her parents had come from Germany. They come to Berlin, to Munich in 1921. They meet this guy Hitler, become great friends, and Putzi becomes one of his first propagandists. And he does things like play Harvard marching songs for Hitler, who says, this is great inspiration for some of the music we should use for the SS and other, our band of thugs, basically. Yeah, you couldn't make these characters up. And then Putzi's wife becomes kind of this object of fascination of Hitler, and she begins to play a very instrumental role. He keeps coming back to visit them, in part to see Helen. And there's even an episode, which I describe in detail in my book, but just to telegraph it here, where after the Beer Hall Putsch, this attempt in 1923 by Hitler to take power that goes disastrously wrong, he's trying to escape, he shows up on Helen's doorsteps, spends the night in the house, and when the police are coming in to arrest him, and Helen tells him the police is coming, he has a gun in his hand. And in this moment, the details are all spelled out, but whether or not he actually intended to, it appears that Hitler wants to commit suicide, at least to Helen it does, and she takes action to prevent that. You think about the implications of something like that in 1923, and it's kind of staggering.
It is, in fact. I mean, you say that she changed the course of history.
Well, she certainly did if he really intended to do what it appeared he was doing.
Mm-hmm. And then there was Dodd, who's an interesting character. He was the ambassador. Is that his title? Am I correct?
Yes,
there?
He was Roosevelt's choice in 1933 to be ambassador to Germany after Hitler took power. He was a University of Chicago historian who had actually studied as a young man in Germany. So he seemed like a good choice in that he knew Germany from before, had basic sympathy for Germany in many ways and German culture. And in fact, Roosevelt had had a lot of troubles finding an ambassador for Germany. A lot of politicians had turned him down and businessmen. So Dodd goes over, who's basically a very decent individual, a genuine Democrat with a small d, also with a large d, but in terms of just his impulse to try to reach out and see if he can't make connections with this new regime, when people still don't know exactly how sinister it is going to become. But he gets to Germany and quickly is so appalled by what he sees of the behavior of the Nazis that he wants less and less to do with him, which puts him in kind of an awkward position. It's morally very commendable in many ways, but it means that he's not exactly effective as an ambassador.
Because he really did not want to have too much to do with them. We're talking with Andrew Nagorski about his wonderful book. It's called Hitlerland, American Eyewitnesses to the Nazi Rise to Power. Now, Dodd is a little bit, I mean, his character is not flamboyant exactly, quite the opposite. But that of his daughter is, she really got around. Tell us about Martha Dodd.
Well, Martha Dodd, if to say she got around is quite an understatement. Yes, Martha Dodd comes to Berlin at age 24. She's already been married and divorced, although she does not reveal that fact, interestingly enough, to people in Berlin. And at first, she is convinced that the Nazis and Hitler are just wonderful. They're terribly misunderstood. She has various affairs with various Nazis. She scandalizes the embassy with her social behavior. And then she begins to also have affairs with other diplomats and visiting writers, for instance, Thomas Wolfe. And by the way, there's a steady procession of very prominent Americans like Thomas Wolfe, Sinclair Lewis, Dorothy Thompson going through Berlin. And eventually her trajectory takes her, and she becomes has a love affair with a Soviet diplomat and becomes a Soviet spy. So this young woman, let's say, has, personally, politically, in every other way, has gone from one extreme to the other. And it's interesting, she is, at a certain point, when she becomes a Soviet spy, she actually offers according to the documents of what was then called the NKVD, what we later become known as the KGB, to spy even on her father in the sense of stealing documents from his office if they wanted. So this is a woman who, let us say, I think sexual behavior is one thing that you can think what you like of that, but that behavior for me, I think for many readers, who will convey the idea that while she was called vivacious and charming in many ways, there was a treacherous side to her that was very strong.
And even probably remained a Soviet spy. Is that right, after the war?
Yes. I mean, there was. It's interesting, after the war, she comes back to the United States. She actually, even before the war, she came back to the United States. She married a rather wealthy financier. And then after the war, in the early 50s, she summoned before the House on American Activities on suspicion that she is a communist. Of course, this is a time of witch hunts and revelations, some of which are true, some of which are made up. She flees the country with her husband. They go to Mexico. They eventually end up in Prague, where they spend the rest of their lives. Later on, much later, I believe in the 70s, the charges against her were formally dropped for lack of evidence, but others like Richard Helms of the CIA, who, by the way, had been a young reporter in Berlin in the 30s, he's one of the other characters in the book, says that the predominant evidence of the what came out of the Soviet KGB archives after the collapse of communism indicated that, yes, she was a spy all along.
And there are others also, George Kennan. Now, was George Kennan involved at all with the CIA as well later on?
No. George Kennan was a State Department official. He was the head of policy planning staff, most famously. He was, of course, a diplomat. He far better known for his time both as a diplomat and an ambassador later in the Soviet Union. But in fact, he comes to Berlin in 1940 to serve in the Berlin Embassy as a senior diplomat in the Berlin Embassy, not the number one, but basically the number two at the embassy. And he's there for the last period when the American Embassy is there. World War II, remember, has already started. Germany has invaded Poland in 1939, but the U.S. is not yet in the war. And he serves there all the way until Pearl Harbor, Germany declares war on the United States, and then, which what's the last part of my book, Hitlerland, the last American diplomats and journalists are rounded up and interned in a spa town in near Frankfurt for several months while their counterparts in the United States are also held, by the way, in a very plush conditions in a resort in West Virginia, which is, you may have heard about, the Greenbrier, which is one of the most closest thing the United States has the full-scale European spa. And the fact that George Kennan was in fact if there were two senior diplomats who were in charge, there was no longer an ambassador in Berlin, but who were during the internment, and his stories of what it was like to try to herd these Americans together and keep them occupied while they were waiting to be exchanged is also one of the more interesting, lesser-known stories of the war years.
One of the things that's so interesting is really how many ideas, like anti-Semitism, that Americans who were not Jewish, shared with the Nazis. How the reason that it was easy for them to be taken in was because kind of all the right notes were being hit by Hitler and the Nazis, at least until things became more open, the brutality.
Yes, when before, say, Kristallnacht, for instance, in 1938, the attacks on all Jewish stores and so forth, where it became obvious that this was not just your run-of-the-mill anti-Semitism, which was so obvious, anti-Semitism was a fact of life in American society, in many Western European societies during this period, and then the folks who were sort of the most eager to to bend over backwards and accommodate the Nazis would even sometimes say this openly. For instance, Avery Brundage, who was the head of the American Olympic Committee in 1936, comes over ostensibly to check out whether the Nazis are going to fulfill their pledge not to discriminate against Jewish athletes if the Olympics are held there, because there's a big debate should the United States go along with these Olympics or not. And at one point, he tells some of the Nazi officials, well, in my Chicago men's club, we don't admit Jews either. So there's that casual acceptance of anti-Semitism. And it's interesting that even some American Jews who go there at first think this anti-Semitism, they're inclined to think, is no different than what there is in American society. There was an American labor organizer by the name of Abraham Plotkin who came over there in late 1932, just as Hitler was about to take power, and stay there for a couple months. And he describes in his diaries how he was talking to German Jews, and they were saying, well, do you have anti-Semitism in the U.S. too? And he'd say, yes, and we had a KKK, so we have radical movements. And they had to explain to him, look, but you don't live in the kind of daily fear we do. What we are experiencing here is of a whole different dimension. And he was quite skeptical at first. And many American Jews at first were often hard put to understand how drastically different this was in terms of scale. Then the other thing is that some German Jews as well initially did not want to believe how dangerous the Nazis were and how dangerous Hitler was. One of the stories I tell early in Hitlerland is of the Consul General in Munich, Robert Murphy, who later became a very famous diplomat, and he worked closely with a German employee in the consulate who was Jewish, a man by the name of Paul Drey, and they actually witnessed some of the early Hitler rallies. And Paul Drey kept telling him, this guy will never go anywhere in Germany. The German public is much too sophisticated and educated to go for such populist drivel. And even after Hitler takes power and Murphy has moved on, he tries to get Drey out of Germany and tells him, I can get you out, I can get you a job. And Drey refuses to go, saying, this is going all going to pass. And Drey dies in Dachau in 1938.
Mm. You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Andrew Nagorski about his book, Hitlerland, American Witnesses to the Nazi Rise to Power. There's also an interesting segment. You mentioned the Olympics, the 1933 Olympics in Berlin. Jesse Owens, you know, the African-American star, was the star of the Olympics, even the Germans themselves idolized him to some degree. He stayed away from politics, but was it him who made the point that he faces the kind of discrimination that the Jews faced? I mean, that he may have been more afraid at home. I mean, in some way, he also minimized it, because the whole issue of racism in the U.S., complicated the responses of people to the anti-Semitism in Germany.
Yes, it did. And the black athletes, it's interesting, even though there were various racist statements, the Nazis tried to tone down their racist declarations during the Olympics to try to pretend that this wasn't a major part of their program. But what happened was with Jesse Owens, despite the fact that he was sort of shunned by Hitler directly, German audiences, the crowds, loved Jesse Owens, and he and other black athletes were sometimes even invited to people's homes, and they felt welcome on a private level. So it was something where they could have the impression, well, this would not happen to me in many cases in the United States in those days. And it's interesting, one of the visitors there who came on a fellowship at the time was W.E.B. Du Bois, the famous black historian and sociologist. And he wrote about this, and he said, you know, it's very hard for a casual visitor to Germany, black or white, to understand what's going on here. And he said, you know, during my few months here, even though I'm black, I've been treated courteously, and I could go away with the impression that things are not so bad here. But when I see, because I speak German and read German, what's happening to the Jews, I realize there is an intensity and a danger level here that far surpasses what passes for daily racism in the United States, even in the 30s. And if you don't speak the language, if you don't understand the culture and see, really observe what's going on, you could miss all that.
Hmm. Now, you've covered the collapse of the Soviet Empire. I mean, you've been a journalist for many years, many decades. You've covered the collapse of the Soviet Empire, the liberation of Central Europe. With the benefit of 2020 hindsight now, how do you judge your first draft of that history?
Good question. Yeah, I would say, first of all, I cannot claim by any means to have predicted exactly what was going to happen, or certainly when it was going to happen. When I was in the Soviet Union in the early 80s, and then covering Eastern Europe and the beginnings of the Solidarity Movement in Poland and so forth, I sensed the system was fundamentally coming unglued, but how long it would take to come unglued, I would never have predicted the speed in which that would happen and then in which it would collapse. And there's always this sense of the things that you see on a daily basis. It's hard to imagine that those institutions and that way of life can evaporate as quickly as it does. So that made me quite sympathetic, I think, to many of the people even who get things wrong in Germany. And as I told you, one of my motivations for doing this, first of all, I would not ever have done a straight history of this period because so many great straight histories have been done. But when I began to discover that there were so many interesting, previously unpublished, in many cases, memoirs, correspondence, diaries, and that I could, and sometimes through the families of these people, I could find out all sorts of original documents, then I began to realize I hadn't really thought about what it must have been like to cover these epic events at the time. I didn't even know, for instance, that among the journalists like William Shirer and others in the 30s, they began to referring informally to this country as that they were covering as Hitlerland. That's not a made-up title in the sense that it's an actual term that they used. So particularly when we look back at Nazi Germany, at Hitler, I think there's a natural tendency to think, if there's anything in any historical event that should have been perfectly clear and evident what was going on from the get-go, that should have been it. But if I've written this book to accurately reflect those views and to put readers in the shoes of these Americans, then I think it becomes quite apparent that you had to be pretty damn smart and maybe even a little lucky to get it all right.
Mm. Do you feel like there may be some lessons that we can learn from the story that you tell in Hitlerland that we could apply to what's going on here in this country today?
For me, the lessons are, with someone like Hitler, or frankly Osama bin Laden, who says their aim in life is to destroy anybody they consider their enemy, and the list is a very long one, don't take it as necessarily rhetorical hyperbole, just because in a logical scheme of things, it would be suicidal for them to attempt all that. So I think there are forces in the world, there are people, there are movements who are genuinely dangerous and who threaten our very existence. The other thing that comes through very quickly is the role of the individual and the role of the individual leader. One of the things the Americans in Germany clearly began to figure out, even though sometimes it was more implicit than explicit, that without Hitler's leadership, the Nazi movement probably would have failed. So history is built on these leaders, often these improbable leaders, and sometimes their path to victory could have easily been rerouted somewhere else, or if someone had, for instance, if Hitler had committed suicide, or he had been killed, or he had just simply fallen by the wayside for any other reason, the course of history would have been quite different. So the choices we make about who we confront, how we confront them, and then determining who are the real threats to our existence are tremendously difficult. And they do. And then within a democracy, of course, they raise all the questions, what's legitimate, what's not, how do you handle people like that? And those are terribly difficult questions that we're all grappling with to this day.
Well, it is a wonderful book and a terrific read, by the way, as well. Hitlerland, we've been talking with Andrew Nagorski, the author. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Andrew Nagorski was a foreign correspondent and editor for Newsweek and now is director of public policy for the East-West Institute. In addition to Hitlerland, he's the author of The Greatest Battle, Stalin, Hitler, and the Desperate Struggle for Moscow that Changed the Course of World War II. Next up, Jonathan Rabb takes us to the same time, but a different country, to the Spanish Civil War. His thriller is called The Second Son. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. As we heard earlier in the show, the Berlin Olympics took place in 1936. Well, that was also the year that the Spanish fascists, led by Francisco Franco and supported by Hitler, took up arms to topple Spain's democratically elected leftist Republican government. The bloody civil war that ensued took tens of thousands of lives, and Franco ruled as dictator until 1975. The breakout of the Spanish Civil War provides a setting for Jonathan Rabb's new novel, The Second Son, which opens with the Spanish Republicans' aborted attempt to hold a counter-Olympics to those taking place in Berlin. The Second Son is the third in Jonathan Rabb's trilogy, featuring Chief Inspector Nikolai Hafner of Berlin as his protagonist. Hafner, a half-Jew in Hitler's Germany, travels to Spain to locate his second son, Georg, who's gone missing in the sudden outbreak of the Spanish Civil War. In Rabb's second book in the series, Hafner loses his first son to the Nazis. Now, in The Second Son, he's determined to save the one son he can. But before we got into the meat of the novel, I asked Jonathan Rabb what drew him to this period in history. His first novel, Rosa, takes place in 1919 with the assassination of Rosa Luxemburg in Berlin.
Well, I was originally drawn to Rosa Luxemburg in 1919, and I thought when I originally started writing that book that there would be just one book. I loved Rosa herself. She's this fantastic figure in history. She rallies an entire country to revolution. She's one of the great thinkers and theorists. And the revolution comes to a screeching halt when she is assassinated on the 15th of January, 1919. Her body doesn't show up again until it's found floating in a canal 4 months later in Berlin, and there's always been speculation about what happened during those 4 months, and that's what that first book was all about. But as I got deeper into the research of the period and the place, and in fact, as I discovered my central character, Nikolai Hafner, I realized I had a lot more to say about the period and certainly extending beyond 1919. And that drew me to 1927 with Shadow and Light. And there the backdrop is the very beginning of talkies in film. Most people think that that's in the United States, but the actual invention of the technology is in Germany. And then Hollywood steals it wonderfully and takes it back to the United States. And I needed to finish my story, and that's why I end in 36. The move to Spain was crucial, at least for me, is because building up through 1919, 1927, the violence that certainly is going to explode is just bubbling beneath the surface. And even though it's closer in 36 in Germany, it's still not there. But the violence that I needed really does erupt in those first 2 weeks of the Spanish Civil War, and that's why I take my character and his two sons to Spain in the summer of 36.
Yeah, and actually the Nazis had something to do with the violence of the Spanish Civil War, isn't that right?
Oh, of course, absolutely. And in fact, that's one of the elements. Yeah, I'm not that interested in sort of the full-fledged, fully developed idea of the Nazis in any of the books. They're always there, obviously. How can you avoid them? But it's much more that they exist on the periphery and how they influence so many other things that are going on even before they take full control. And yes, without the Germans, Franco would never have been able to win the war. He would never have had the men, he would never have had the armaments, he would never have had the tanks, the airplanes.
And am I wrong? Was it German airplanes given to the Spanish that bombed Guernica?
Oh, sure. I mean, that's later. Yeah. That's over a year later. But in 36, in order to get the Spanish Civil War begins in this part of the book, small part of the book, there was going to be in the summer of 36 a protest Olympic Games against the Nazi Olympics, which, of course, took place in 1936 in Berlin. You know, the famous picture of Jesse Owens winning his four medals and Hitler sort of begrudgingly taking him up to the president or the chancellor's box. the Spaniards had decided to boycott the games entirely, and there were a number of countries that said, we're going to boycott, including the United States. But, of course, we all showed up. The Spanish said, no, we're not going to go. And to voice even greater, not just displeasure, but, you know, real abhorrence about what was going on there in Germany, they said, we're going to have our own week of Olympics, and it's going to be a proletariat Olympics. And so we're going to have the usual lineup of, you know, running races and other sporting events. But they also included, as Olympic sports, folk dancing, singing, chess, you know, a real proletariat, fantastic Olympic Games. And these are supposed to begin on the 19th of July, about a week before the Berlin Games are to begin. Franco and his soldiers unleash the war in northern Africa the day before, and those Olympics never take place. And so in order to get Franco over from North Africa into mainland Spain, he needs German, part of the Wehrmacht, he needs, and the Luftwaffe, to bring him over. And that is a small element of this book. So that's a very long answer to your very short question.
Oh, well, it's a wonderful answer. And in fact, I mean, I'd love to dive into the book, but I want to give our listeners just one more piece of background. Tell us a little bit about how this came about. I mean, what was the Spanish Republic? Who were they? And who were the fascists?
Well, I mean, it's Spain in the 30s is, late 20s, early 30s is an extraordinary place. When that Spanish government decides to boycott and then protest, and in fact, they were known as the protest games, protest the Berlin Olympics. It's a leftist government, democratically leftist government. It's social democrats, not quite calling themselves that, but a socialist government, but democratically driven, but certainly well on the left. For us to understand sort of the nuances of what their understanding of what they were, it would take too long. But just to understand, they are a leftist government. And there are communists, socialists, anarchists, and so forth, all as elements of the fabric of the politics of Spain at the time. And things are going along, maybe not as smoothly as one would hope, but certainly smoothly enough. And on the right are two groups, the Carlists and the Falangists. One of the Carlists want the monarchy back. The Falangists are, you know, date back far enough so that you have these two different elements of the right. And they are out of power, and obviously many members of the military want that kind of right-wing order, that kind of fascist order, to be imposed back on what they see as the mayhem of the left running the country. And Franco is certainly one of those. And Franco's genius is ultimately that he is able to take these two disparate lines of the right, the Carlists and the Falangists, and bring them together under one strong right-wing fascist force. I mean, in the long history of the left versus the right is always much better at having one unified voice. And Franco and his men, there's a rift within the military. They surge up from, you know, North Africa. They come across into Spain. They begin to move their way up. But in the first 2 weeks of the war, which are the weeks that I look at, it really looks like the left's going to win. I mean, it's this incredible moment when you think, holy smokes. I mean, you've got Barcelona, the troops that are there come surging out, and the anarchists and the socialists. And the communists were a very small group at that time. A lot of people, you know, always assume that when the left rises, it's got to be the communists. No, in this case, it was really the anarchists who were a crucial, crucial element in turning back the fascists, especially in Barcelona, but throughout the country. And then the national government comes to them and says, don't you want to be part of, you know, running all of this now? And the anarchists look at the government and say, no, we're anarchists. We don't want anything to do with running the government. And things go from there, and they get worse from there.
Yeah. So, I mean, we should point out, interestingly enough, that the longest-running anarchist cooperatives in the world, I believe, are the Spanish anarchist cooperatives at Mondragon. So they're not necessarily against organization.
No, of course not.
They're just against the state.
Well, and, you know, what people don't realize, you know, everybody here in this country hears anarchists and thinks, you know, people just running up against things, blowing things up. Absolutely not. The anarchists in Spain at that time were the ones who wanted to, you know, shut down the brothels, get rid of alcohol. They wanted sort of this nice, austere life so that people wouldn't have to be controlled by something beyond themselves. They wanted these collectives. They wanted things to work that way. In some sense, the anarchists are the most ethically driven group in Spain at the time and had been for, you know, decades. It's, you know, we ascribe some idea of what anarchists must be all about. They themselves did not view themselves that way, nor did they act that way. So you're absolutely right. Their longevity was based on that kind of internal stability that they could create.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So now, to your book, Jonathan Rabb, The Second Son, it does open up with those counter-Olympics about to be planned. We see the son of Chief Inspector Nikolai Hafner. Set the scene for us. Tell us what's happening. He's writing some letters to his wife, which I found very interesting as well. So talk a little bit about this opening scene. And we have to warn our listeners, we do lose sight of him in this novel very soon after that. So he's not the main character.
No. I mean, as I said, when I first started writing Rosa, which the book takes place in 1919, the youngest son, Georg, is 8 years old at that time. And the older boy, Sasha, is 16. By the time we get to this book, and you should know, the reader should know that up until this book, it hasn't really made a difference. But in this book, of course, it's 1936, so it does make a difference. Hofner himself is a half-Jew. His mother was Jewish, which of course, after the Nuremberg laws, makes him absolutely non-Aryan, Jewish descent, and so forth. His youngest son, Georg, who in the second book, and I hope I don't confuse anybody here, goes to work for one of the German film studios, the big one, UFA, in 1927. So by the time this book begins in 36, he is a young director filmmaker for the Pathé Gazette organization. That's the famous, you know, rooster going, cock-a-doodle-doo, you are there. It's an English film company, news company, but there are divisions within Germany and France and so forth. And he has been sent, the younger son, to Spain to film these protest games. And the letters that he sends back to his wife, to his own young son, and in fact, another little bit of information, he has converted fully to Judaism himself. A dangerous thing, obviously, to do in the 1930s in Germany, but he fell in love with a Jewish woman. They have a Jewish home in Berlin, which, of course, will, you know, be devastating later on. And he is writing letters back to his wife and to his father, Nikolai, explaining to them what this sort of situation is in Spain. And he actually is in Barcelona on the nights that the first shots are fired. And he has his film camera and he's, you know, taking shots and so forth. And then suddenly all communication with him stops. And of course, the Civil War has begun, and he has disappeared, and it's uncertain what has happened to him. Meanwhile, back in Berlin, his father, Nikolai, who has been a member of the criminal polizei, the criminal police department, and has solved any number of crimes. I have him solving crimes having to do with Rosa Luxemburg and the advent of film in the previous books, is summarily kicked out of the police because of his Jewish lineage. Mm-hmm. And he decides he has to go find his son. I should add to this that his older son, at the end of the first book, has grown so disillusioned with his father, and I will admit to this, my main character, Nikolai, is not the best of men. He has the best of intentions, he thinks, but it makes it for a much more complex, real character. And his son, his older son, Sasha, at the end of the first book, is devastated by his father. In the second book, it continues on, and Sasha has actually changed his name to his mother's maiden name. She was not Jewish, and is now a member of the Nazi Party.
Now, Chief Inspector Nikolai Hofner has gone to Spain to look for his son. He kind of gets in with, or and goes to these gun runners, these criminal elements, and they help him out. They protect him. There's almost a kind of honor of thieves here that's in contrast to the mayhem that's going on around them. Is that historically true, or is this an element of drama that you introduce in your book?
No, I mean, the gun runners and so forth, as you refer to them, there was a very fine line between who was a freedom fighter and who was just purely a criminal, and sometimes that line was very, very murky. In fact, one of the characters early on says to Hoffner, "Tell me, which one am I? Because I pulled a rich banker out of a car and garroted him and took his money and gave it to poor people, does that make me a criminal? In Berlin, it does. Here, it doesn't." And, you know, that's the mindset, whether or not those people, they were known as the incontrolats, the uncontrollables. Whether they went too far was certainly up to the anarchists to decide for themselves. And, in fact, they got rid of some of their own incontrollables in order to show the socialists and the communists that they could control themselves. I mean, there was a lot of internal proving themselves to each other among these groups. But it's not that much of a stretch to think that in that kind of mayhem, everyone is a Spaniard. You know what I mean?
They're
fighting for the Spain that they believe, mm-hmm. whether they've been a second-story pickpocket or a gun runner or whatever. And the reason also that I do it is because in the previous two books, Hoffner has always worked with the underbelly of Berlin, the criminal syndicates, to solve these larger crimes. Hoffner is a man who thinks there are certain crimes he can turn his back on and say it doesn't really matter. But the larger ones that sort of cut at the fabric of society, which in those first two books, that's what it's all about, then everyone's fighting to save Germany. Everyone's fighting to save Berlin. So here in Spain, it made perfect sense for me that he would, you know, link up with this less than savory, less than legal group. And they take to him, obviously, because they have connections to the Berlin syndicates as well. But soon enough, he's off on his own. But they are crucial at the beginning. You're absolutely right.
Now, the involvement of the other European powers, you know, I think it's probably safe to say that Georg, the younger son, is a British spy. He's working for the British.
He is, absolutely. And that's something that his father doesn't really know. He does when he gets to Spain, but in the early parts of the book, he doesn't. I mean, one element of these three books, in the very first book, Hoffner is a very, very good detective. As long as he knows his city, Berlin, and feels comfortable with it, and he's a man who, his Berlin is Wilhelmine Berlin, you know, when Wilhelm was there under the Kaiser. The moment that begins to go, in every subsequent book, as his Berlin drifts farther and farther away, he becomes worse and worse at what he used to do, which is understanding things, being a detective. So at the beginning of the book, he's just not aware of what his son is. And yes, Georg is working for Pathé Gazette as a German in Germany, but working for the English. And it makes sense. A Jew in Germany at that time certainly would have been trying to help the English.
And so are the British heroes here?
No. No one's really a hero except for my anti-hero. Only Nikolai Hoffner and the woman he meets. Those are the true heroes. I think it's hard to... I mean, I certainly have my political leanings, but I'm not going to tell you that, you know, the socialists and the anarchists were purely noble, and I'm not going to tell you, and I know this sounds very strange, that the fascists were purely dark and evil. I have one crucial scene where Hoffner and the woman he's traveling with run into a fascist who has, you know, sort of stabilized the little town, and it's all faith-driven for him, and one of the lines he has is, "What is Spain without God? What is God without Spain?"
Hmm.
And that sort of defined, at least for me, an element within that fascist movement. Not that I cotton to it, not that I agree with it, but there's a gray area in everything. So to say, is anyone good? I mean, the Americans were helping out or turning a blind eye to the left because Texaco wanted to sell gas, and they wanted to sell fuel to Franco. You know, we were there too. Everyone was sitting back and waiting to see who was going to come out. And they were also using Spain as a sort of a run-through of what was about to explode. And they all knew it was going to explode, not necessarily in 39, but they knew that the Second World War was coming. I mean, some people have always argued, and I might agree with them, that there really wasn't a World War I and a World War II. There was just one massive war with a little break in the middle.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it is astounding. I have elements of this in the second book. As Germany begins, that takes place in 27, as right-wing elements in Germany, not the Nazis, but right-wing elements in Germany start to sort of rethink their position in the world. And if you look at the end of the First World War, before the Americans get in, you have a classic European conflict where stalemate, and usually what had happened for the previous 500 years is everyone just sort of stood up and said, okay, let's divvy up some land, you take your debt, I'll take mine, sorry we did this, now let's go back and do what we do. The Americans enter the war, and suddenly there is a true victor and a true devil who started all of the problems, and everything gets lumped onto Germany. Now, I'm not excusing what happened afterwards, and I'm not saying that Germany wasn't aggressive and started the war, the Blitzkrieg, but the question is, why did they start the war in 14? Well, could it have been that France and England and Belgium were basically, and even Italy, were dividing up Africa as colonies, and Germany was kept out of that, so they felt they needed to get... I mean, I'm not a historian of that period, but, you know, you could see that there was justification, let's put it that way, on both sides. But at the end of the war, there is no justification. Mm-hmm. America, France, England, and somehow Italy, who had fought with Germany at the beginning of the war, they're the victors. And Germany has to take the brunt of everything. And that basically, that kind of triumphalism that the Allies are allowed to, you know, experience sets things up very poorly for Europe at the time. Plus, America, you know, goes in, conquering hero, and then goes home and says, you take care of the rest.
You're talking about World War One.
We're not going to be part of this. No, after World War II, of course, the Marshall Plan and so forth. We figured out that we'd made a huge mistake after World War One. But had Europe been left to Europe to fight the way Europeans had fought for the previous 500 years, and Germany wouldn't have been named the loser and everyone else the winners, who knows if things would have been fertile ground for the Freikorps that comes back from the front and disenfranchised, angry, now no way to make a living. You know, the Depression, on some level, begins in Germany years before it hits the United States. I mean, the massive inflation and so forth. And these guys roaming around, angry and wanting a fight. Well, that Freikorps becomes, those roaming soldiers coming back, become the brown shirts. The brown shirts pave the way, they pave the way for everything else that's going to go on.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Jonathan Rabb about his latest novel, The Second Son.
Now, there is, of course, another very famous book that treats the Spanish Civil War, George Orwell's Homage to Catalonia.
Yes.
Did that have any influence on the writing of your book?
Enormous. You know, I'm delighted that you brought that up. Orwell's understanding of what was going on there is really quite powerful. I mean, he's there, he's fighting, and he understands, a leftist through and through, but he understands the fragility, the frailty of what the left is all about. And the way he is able to describe those moments going out into the flats and into the hills and so forth and fighting the battle is really extraordinary. Another book that was absolutely instrumental by Arthur Koestler, the Hungarian journalist who wrote Darkness at Noon, which is about, I think, his experience in a Spanish prison for a year during the war. Those two were really instrumental in shaping my idea of what Spain was all about, much more so. A lot of people always say, well, Spain, Civil War, you must have been reading Hemingway. And Hemingway's characters come with, you know, they come with their nobility fully intact. There is no time that you question Robert Jordan. He might have difficult choices, but there is just this, you know, that wonderful sort of Gary Cooper chin sticking out nobly. And that just wasn't my experience reading about it or the characters that I was bringing. My character, Hoffner, is no one's going to confuse him with Gary Cooper.
What are his flaws?
What aren't his flaws? Let's start there. Now, as I said, in the first book, he is a wonderful detective. His analytic mind is really quite extraordinary. Not that anybody else at the criminal police eye respects him. I mean, they do begrudgingly. But it's not as if they go around going, well, we've got Nikolai Hoffner working for us. Look at us. They think he's clever by half. They think he thinks he's smarter, and he is. But he it's not that he's a boastful person, but he's that kind of guy who you just it just rubs you the wrong way. But he is brilliant at what he does. But that is the only place where he exhibits any kind of real control, any kind of real ethical standard. He is not a good husband. He in the first book, he just to give you an example, he starts dating his partner's young girlfriend, who is 16. You know, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. He has two young sons who he has no idea how to communicate with them. And he wants to, but he's afraid of them. He's afraid of the older boy especially, and wonders when the little boy, Georg, at that time is 8. There's a scene at one point when he comes and he hugs the little boy, and he feels that sort of wonderful boniness of an 8-year-old boy's little back, and he feels the little arms around him, and all he can think of that time is, when am I going to disappoint and betray this one? So he's self-aware, which I guess is a saving grace, even though he just, a very good friend of mine who's read a number of books when he first read the book said, every single time Hoffner makes a choice, I think to myself, oh no, no, no. But I know why he has to make it. And, you know, that was very satisfying to hear, but that's the kind of character I want, and that's the kind of character I needed at that moment. I mean, that period between the wars, you know, we have an image of Cabaret and, you know, Isherwood and Auden and so forth. And Berlin at the time was so much darker, so much seedier, and so much uncertain, so much more uncertain, and I needed a character who reflected that. And then when I was about halfway through that first book, I realized I had the opportunity to chart the decline, not only of Berlin, but perhaps other parts of Europe, through the decline of this family, the father and his two sons. And that's, in fact, exactly what happens in the three books. But he's not a good man, but he's mine, and I love him.
and so much fun to write.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Well, Jonathan Rav, it's just been delightful to talk with you about all your books, including the latest, The Second Son. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Jonathan Rav is the author of two previous novels in the Chief Inspector Nikolai Hoffner series, Shadow and Light and Rosa, as well as two other novels.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon, at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. Drew Adamek is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.